Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many of us grew up with Mr. Rogers singing about how he'd like to be our neighbor on public television. Later this hour, I'll talk with jazz vocalist Carrie Johnsrud about her updated interpretations of the music of Fred Rogers. But first, Nicole Hannah Jones grew up in Waterloo, Iowa in the 1980s. Her neighborhood school was, as her mother described it, distressingly chaotic. And after first grade, her parents decided to have her and her sister bused across town as part of the school's voluntary desegregation program. Fast forward to today, and Hannah Jones is an award-winning journalist who's written a great deal about education, race, and segregation. She was awarded the so-called MacArthur Genius Grant in 2017, and she is with me today. Hello, Nicole.
Hello, good morning.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back in time to Waterloo, Iowa in the 1980s. Describe the neighborhood you grew up in to me.
I grew up on what we call the east side of town, which is really the north side of town, on the other side of the Cedar River. That is where most of the black population, at least in my childhood, lived. I lived in a neighborhood that was very working class. It was actually fairly racially mixed, right near the river, but very working class.
And in talking to your parents about why they decided to get involved in the voluntary desegregation program and bus you and your sister across town, what did they say about your school?
So I should say, I never talked to my parents about this until a few years ago when I was writing a piece on my own daughter. It wasn't something that we discussed when I was a child. Like most children, your parents tell you to get on a bus and go to school, and you get on the bus and go wherever that bus takes
right.
you, and you don't ask questions about it. It wasn't until I was writing a piece about the process of choosing a school for my own daughter that I began to really reflect on the busing program I was in, and I asked my mom about it as an adult. My father had already passed away by then. And what my mom said was she was very concerned about the public school that I was in, which was a very low-income school, and she felt that as working-class parents, the one opportunity she could ensure for me was to get me in this program and send me to a more affluent, better-performing school. So that's what they did.
And what are your memories of getting on that bus? And you had a very long bus ride as part of this program. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, the bus ride was about an hour each way, so I spent about 2 hours on the bus every day. This bus would go all across the east side picking up black kids and dropping off. So our bus would pick up elementary school, middle school, and high school kids and drop us all off at our subsequent schools. What I remember about the actual school was I remember academically it was challenging. I was in the talented and gifted program, and I enjoyed the school academically very much, and I remember just feeling like I was always learning a lot. Socially, it was very, very difficult. We were not only one of a handful of black kids in the school, we were one of a handful of low-income school kids in the school. All of my classmates lived in the neighborhood. At the end of the school day, we would have to immediately get on our bus and go back home, which made it very clear that this wasn't actually our school. And I got teased a lot. I got teased for being black. I just remember that it was, I tended to really gravitate towards some of the other friends who rode the bus with me as well. So my best friend in high school, or excuse me, elementary school, was Yeshia Bebe, who was also a black girl who was bused from the other side of town.
And you mentioned the article that you wrote, Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City. You wrote that in June of 2016 in the New York Times Magazine. And in that article, you give credit, possibly, for being a part of that busing program, getting you from point A to point B, where here you are, in a very successful, highly respected journalist. Do you think that really made the difference?
So I've been writing about school segregation for about 15 years now, and I know that all of the data and research shows that in this country, segregated schools are harmful. And what the research actually shows is that the brightest students get harmed the most by segregated schools. So I clearly can't draw a direct line and say that had my parents not put me in that program, I would not have been where I am. But I think there are a good chance that I would not have been. I have spent a lot of time with high school kids, very, very bright high school kids who attend segregated schools that don't have the type of curriculum and instruction that you tend to find in schools with large numbers of white kids. And what I can tell you is they have a very hard time getting high test scores on SAT and ACT to get them into good colleges. A lot of times they enter college, even though they were top students in their high school, they enter college academically behind. They have to take remedial courses. So, and these, again, are very, very motivated, bright students. So if that is happening, it would be, I think, silly for me not to think that that would have been possible for me as well.
Now, at the same time that you were going to school in Waterloo, I was over in Cedar Falls. We were in the same grade. I was over in Cedar Falls at an elementary school that was a very segregated school. I had two black kids in my grade all the way through. So it was a predominantly white. There was a little bit more of a socioeconomic mix, but not much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at that community, and of course, my lack of understanding as a child, but I just want to mention that because when we talk about the schools in Waterloo being segregated in the 1980s, and I know this is something that they still struggle with in Waterloo, it's a bigger issue than just one town.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for obvious reasons, we tend to talk about school segregation in the ways that it harms Black and Latino kids. And that's because it literally can harm their ability to achieve academically in a way that allows them to enjoy all the opportunities that this country can offer. But we rarely talk about the harms that segregation has on white children as well. But it does. I mean, your experience clearly didn't reflect our country. It did not give you the opportunity to learn in classrooms with kids from varying perspectives. I often jokingly say, you know, I was the kid from the wrong side of town that white parents were afraid of, but I was actually smarter than most of the kids in the school. And so we have this false sense of what race means and how race correlates with intelligence, and it simply doesn't. So when we segregate schools, we're depriving all children of the opportunity to learn with children who can round out their experience, who can give them a broader perspective, and frankly, who can bring minds into the classroom that can challenge other children academically. I do wish we would talk more about that.
When you decided to write that article about how you chose where to send your daughter to school, I mean, you had been doing a lot of reporting on education, on segregation, on race for a long time, and then you were faced with this decision living in Brooklyn, New York, where the schools are highly segregated, trying to decide where your daughter would go. First of all, why did you decide you wanted to share that personal story? It's a different kind of journalism to share that kind of story, and I'm sure it opened you up to a lot of people wanting to make comments about your life and your personal decisions. How did you decide that you would open up that way?
Yeah, it was a difficult decision, and it took me a while to come to it. I had been writing, as you mentioned, about school segregation pretty exclusively for the last few years, my husband and I had made a personal decision to enroll our daughter in the type of segregated schools that we talk about. We didn't do it because I intended to ever write about it, but happenstance had it that my daughter's school became embroiled in an integration battle that became national news. My daughter's school is almost entirely Black and Latino. It's almost entirely poor and under-enrolled, and the New York City public schools had decided to rezone some students from an overcrowded white school into my daughter's school, and those parents became very upset. So it became this national news story, and I was watching all of the other stories that were being written about it, and people were calling me, asking me, not knowing that my daughter was in that school, they were asking me, oh, are you looking at what's happening in Brooklyn? Are you going to write about it? And finally, I guess I just became so frustrated that I didn't feel like the coverage was going deep enough, that the coverage was really helping us to understand how in this very progressive place you would have white liberals fighting against integration. And like many journalists, when you become frustrated with what's being reported, you kind of get drawn to try to report it yourself. So I talked to my editors, and then I immediately regretted it and tried to walk it back. But as you know, as a journalist, it's too late.
Right.
Once you entice them with a story, they don't let you walk it back. So I ended up doing the story. And it was probably one of the most challenging to write, to try to be very open about the personal fears and anxieties and conversations that my husband was having, but also trying to not make the story just about me, but make it about kind of our society at large. It was a challenge. And I think what ultimately convinced me that I needed to do it was I realized as a journalist, I'm always asking people to reveal their vulnerabilities to me, and they have no control ultimately over what I write. And it almost felt somewhat hypocritical to then say, and I'm controlling the narrative that I write, that I would not open myself up in the same way that I ask people to do all the time.
Well, and this decision to enroll your daughter in the public school in your neighborhood, and you visited a lot of different schools, and there were a number of different public schools in the neighborhood that you considered, but that decision was not an easy one. It was not an automatic decision for you. And we don't have much time right now before the break, but were you surprised, as someone who clearly feels very strongly about this, that it wasn't an easy decision?
No, I wasn't surprised because, again, I catalog the way that these segregated schools harm children, the way that they don't offer the same academic opportunities. So I knew I would have to give up something for my child, some benefit, in order to put her in that school. I knew that wouldn't be easy, but I was determined that this is what I was going to do, and, you know, then I just had to convince my husband.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Nicole Hannah-Jones. She grew up in Waterloo, Iowa in the 1980s. She is an award-winning journalist. She's written a great deal about education, race, and segregation. She received a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Grant, in 2017. And we'll talk more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with jazz vocalist Carrie Johnsrud about reimagining the music of Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. Right now, I'm talking with Nicole Hannah-Jones. She grew up in Waterloo, Iowa in the 1980s. She was part of a voluntary desegregation program in the city schools back then. Today, she is a journalist who writes about segregation, education, and race issues. She was a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship in 2017. And Nicole, just before the break, we were talking about that article that it kind of blew up, your article in the New York Times Magazine about choosing, the title of the article is Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City. It was published June 9th, 2016, and started so many conversations all across the country. Were you surprised when you shared your personal life in that way, how people reacted to it?
I was. I think you never know how people are going to respond to your work. And this was a particular, I was writing in a very particular way. I decided with this piece that I was going to go directly after white liberals who say they believe in equality, but fight efforts to bring about equality all the time. But that's clearly also who my audience is. So I just wasn't sure what the reaction was going to be to the piece. Were people going to be defensive? Were they not going to pay attention to it? I've been writing about, like I said, school segregation for several years, and I keep trying to find different angles to write about the same thing, so you don't know if people are just tired of the subject or they feel like they already know it. So I really had no idea how it was going to be received at all. I was completely surprised by that.
Well, and it struck a chord, I am sure, with many people who have been faced with hard decisions about their child's education. Suddenly, for a lot of people, whatever they believe, whatever they are willing to vote for and stand up for when their kids are not involved, becomes secondary when all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, this is my kid. They have one life, one chance at an education, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure they have the best education possible. I mean, that is a difficult moment. And I mean, outlining what you and your husband went through, I'm sure helped a lot of people because they've struggled with the same thing. But so many people come down on the other side and make the other decision and do whatever they can for their child. Were you faced with people who were criticizing you, saying, hey, you made the wrong choice, you're putting your kid at risk?
Absolutely. I should say the bulk of the response I got was people saying, you really challenged me, you made me think about the choices I made. The most surprising thing has been the number of people who said they've made a different choice for their child because of this. I think being very honest and not preachy in the piece and saying, look, I struggled with this too, but ultimately had to do what I felt was the moral decision, I think is what really touched people. But I certainly heard from a significant number of people who said, you know, how dare you sacrifice your child? You're not a good parent. You can't sacrifice your own child for some greater good. You're being silly. And my question is very simple. I mean, excuse me, my answer to that is very simple. Whose children do we sacrifice then? Whose children are worthy of being sacrificed in schools that we don't think are good enough for our own kids? And to be clear, we're not talking about private schools here. We're not talking about schools where people have shelled out a ton of money to ensure their kids are getting a better education than other kids. We're talking about public schools. They're publicly funded. They're supposed to bring about equality. I believe that public schools should treat all children equally, that you shouldn't, because of your social status, be able to get into a premier public school while down the street, low-income and black and brown kids have to go into a substandard public school. So I certainly received a lot of people who just really challenged my choice as being naive. But like I said, when I asked them whose kids should we sacrifice, that's a question that they weren't willing to answer. And I think that's what my work is asking us all, is that we are making a choice that some kids are worthy and some kids are not, and that their worth has to do with their status in the society. And I oppose that.
Well, and speaking of educating people, we have a comment on Twitter from an account that is clearly meant to be anonymous, so I don't have a name to go with this. The person said, it's okay to say we're all in this together, so integration is the right thing to do. I mean, how does your guest explain the achievement gap between segregated schools, as she alluded to? What, racist teachers intentionally not teaching calculus and Proust? So here's somebody who doesn't understand what you're writing about and clearly should spend some time reading some of the journalism you've done about it. But you've got to be faced with that kind of lack of understanding all the time. How do you break through that?
Of course. I break through it. I try to break through it, at least through the rigor of the reporting. When I'm writing a piece like this, I am always thinking about what are the objections? What are the things that people will not believe? What will people be skeptical about? And then how can I prove, what the point I'm making, and what the research shows. I'm not making this up in my head because I just believe it to be true. Decades of research have shown this. One, I would recommend the person on Twitter actually read my work. I link to every study, every bit of research and data that I cite. I link to it so that I don't expect people to trust it just because I'm a journalist and I say it so. You can go and look at all the research that I've cited and look at all the data. But it's very simple. We have never, for a single day in this country, provided black children segregated in their own schools the same resources as white children. And that's just the fact. The data from the U.S. Department of Education shows that the more black a school is, the less likely that school is to have a certified teacher, to have an experienced teacher, to even offer physics or chemistry. Many of these schools don't even offer calculus, chemistry, physics at all to these kids. And if they do, they're often not being taught by a certified teacher. They're less likely to have up-to-date textbooks. They're less likely to have up-to-date technology. They're usually in worse facilities. I mean, this is across the board. So, no, it's not. These are actually very tangible and easy to understand things. Simply, we are not giving kids who are away from white kids the same education that we guarantee for white children. And that's it. If we actually don't know what it would look like if we could close that achievement gap if black kids were getting the same thing as white kids, because we've never done it. What we do know is that at the peak of school integration in this country, which was 1988 when I was a middle school student, that's when we had the most black kids attending school with white kids in this country. That's when the racial achievement gap was at its narrowest point. We actually managed in just 15 years of desegregation to close the achievement gap in test scores by half. And once we started resegregating our schools and black kids stopped getting access to those resources that we guarantee for white kids, you saw that achievement gap rise again, and we've never gone back to that narrow point again. So that's actually the easiest question for me to answer.
And which direction are we headed in right now? I mean, you published that article in 2016. It was a moment at which progress probably seemed possible. We've changed a lot since then, as far as leadership in the Department of Education. You've written about the resegregation of schools taking place in, for example, in Jefferson County, Alabama. I mean, what do you see happening right now?
You know, I've been writing about until the recent election, I was writing about school segregation under 8 years of President Obama. I live in one of the most liberal cities in the country, and it is New York City, and it has one of the most segregated large school systems in the country. This, sadly, is not a partisan issue. You don't see any more movement among progressive Democrat voting people to integrate their schools than you see among conservative Republican voting people to integrate their schools. What is true is that our schools, when it comes to black children, are as segregated now as they were in the 1970s. We are moving backwards. We have almost no political will to do anything about this. And I think what my work is doing is trying to push back against that tide and say, we need to stop and look what we're doing to kids. We are producing generations of children who are not receiving an equal quality education, and we've come to accept that. And we've come to accept that whether we're in Iowa or Chicago or New York or Alabama.
Let's talk about public education, period, right now. We're at a point where there is a lot of political push for voucher programs, and our Secretary of Education has basically said that public schools are broken in this country. Are we turning away from public education?
I think we are seeing a wave of privatization of public schools. And I think public school advocates have actually made the ground fertile for this. This whole idea that within public schools, you should be able to have choice, that you should be able to shop around, the way that we've monetized public education, I think has opened the door to actual privatization. The truth is, though, all of these efforts, charter schools, vouchers that claim to even the playing field for children, actually only exacerbate inequality. Voucher programs show kids who are in those voucher programs, low-income children, it shows that their test scores actually decline. They don't do better when they get access to those schools because the vouchers are not, the amount of the voucher is not high enough to get them access to good private schools. And because we're a capitalist country, we assume if you pay for it, it's automatically better. And that's just not the case. Same thing with charter schools. Most charter schools are more segregated than your typical public school. They're drawing resources out of public schools. So I think there's a disturbing trend. And this didn't begin with Betsy DeVos. There was an expansion of funding for charter schools and choice under the Obama administration, and it's continuing now, except I think we might see a greater expansion. People who believe in public schools are going to have to really consider this idea of being able to shop around, because, like I said, the introduction of market terminology into what is supposed to be a common good has opened the door for this.
So I don't expect you to be an expert on Iowa today. You grew up here, but this is not your home state today. But obviously, Iowa is a somewhat unusual place where we have an increasingly diverse population, but we are more homogeneous than many states in the country. And we see in our urban areas increasing diversity in our rural areas, we're not seeing that so much. So what do you think Iowans need to know and to understand about school segregation? Because this is not something that is just happening other places in spite of our sort of unique makeup.
Yeah, it's definitely not. So, I mean, I haven't lived in Iowa since I was graduated high school, but all of my family is still in Waterloo. My best friend from high school teaches elementary school in an all-Black elementary school in Waterloo, and a school that's perpetually on the failing schools list. So Iowa has these same issues of segregation and racial inequality that you see everywhere across the country. I think it can feel very removed from many Iowans because they're not having to deal personally with the impacts of this. But my question is, you know, it was one thing nationally when you could deprive about 15% of your population of a quality education. You could contain the harm of that. But we are at a point now where very quickly children of color will be more than 50% of all children born in this country. They already are 50% of all public school children. If we're not going to provide half of our children with an equal education, who pays our Social Security? Who ensures that we have Medicare? You know, who's able to fill these jobs in the future? So I think we're going to have to stop thinking so much about what individual advantage can we get for our own children and our own lives and start thinking about the bigger picture, which is that there are millions of children who are not able to live up to their potential because of the schools we build for them, and that is eventually going to come to our own doorstep.
So in your reporting, do you see a place where things are going right? Is there a model we can look at? That's not a good response.
My answer is always a letdown because there is no place I think that is doing right by Black children. And that's a hard thing for people to hear, but one only has to look at the data and see that. But there are certainly places that are trying more than others. And almost all of those places are in the South. The South, while it gets its reputation for being the quote-unquote racist part of the country, has been the most integrated part of the country for the last 50 years because it was forced to integrate by the courts and it dealt with it. So if you want to look at models, you can look at Wake County in North Carolina. It serves the capital city of Raleigh. They've been voluntarily integrating schools for the last 40 years. They continue to have a busing and magnet program where they're not just busing a handful of Black kids into schools, but they bus white children as well. And it works because parents have accepted that having good schools and not having one school with everything and another school with nothing is actually good for the city, that it's easier to recruit businesses to recruit talent to a town where you don't have such disparity in the schools. Another place is Jefferson County, Kentucky, which was ordered by a court to integrate. And after that court order ended, again, the business community and the civil rights community got together and understood that integrated schools were the best thing for the community. So they continued to work very hard to integrate their schools. We have very, very few examples outside of the South of communities that are willing to do that.
And
I think what people should understand, I'm sorry if I can
no,
just
go ahead.
Add,
yeah.
Integration ties our fate together. That is what makes it so powerful, is the least of us get tied, the fates of the least of us get tied to the fate of those who have the most power. And that is how you bring about equality. You can't write off an entire school if your kids are in that school. But if your kids aren't in that school and no one who looks like you and no one who lives in your neighborhood are in that school, it's very easy to forget about that school or to not care that that school is not getting the things that it needs. Integration ties our fate together, and that's why it's so necessary.
Well, and what is your message for those white liberals who, okay, I agree with everything you've said, Nicole, but when it comes to my kid, I just can't walk the walk. What's your message?
My message is very easy. Then you don't believe in everything that I said. You cannot believe in equality and then seek to advantage your own child. Those two views are in direct opposition to each other. And I think what's important to understand is inequality, segregation are structural and they are systemic. But as I wrote in my piece, they are upheld every day by our individual choices. If a handful of parents, white parents, make a decision to go into one of these schools, it changes everything about the power in that school. And pretty soon other white parents come. I'm not a white parent, but I clearly, I'm a high-income parent. I work at the New York Times. And I can tell you, when I go in that school and I say something isn't right, it gets fixed. When those poor parents who live in the housing projects, they can demand over and over and over that they want problems in that school fixed, and no one listens to them because they have no power. We have to, if we believe in equality, if we say we have progressive values, then we have to use the power we have to help those of us who don't have it. And it's very easy to hold a view when you don't actually have to live that value. So I think my work is trying to challenge those who say they agree with me, but they're not doing anything different than those people who say they don't agree with me. As Dr. King said, it's not enough to love. He said, Negro, I'll say black people. It's not enough to love black people. You must demand justice. And those are two very different things.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones, we're out of time, but thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on today.
This is Talk of Iowa.